Hello and welcome to the Canadian Cycling Magazine podcast. We just heard a chainsaw of encouragement. It was from Cyclocross Nationals fairly recently in Peterborough, Ontario. And we're going to hear a bit more from Cyclocross Nationals. But first, hello, Dan. How's it going?
Matthew, my feelings are hurt.
What? Why are your feelings hurt?
Your namesake ruined my weekend. And by namesake, I mean Matthew Vanderpool.
I mean, we do share a first name. That's the only tenuous connection you can find between me.
Let me just paint this picture I had.
All right, let me tell
you. For you and your namesake.
He's not my namesake.
I came home from hockey practice, coaching, got up early, had my whole mid-morning afternoon plan focused around the cross race, coffee, bagel, everything was set. As soon as I start to settle in, tune bobbles, Matthew Vanderpool goes off the front.
Yeah.
Race over.
I'm sorry. So you're a bit peeved that he's so good.
And I feel like it's your fault.
All right. Well, we can take that up later. We'll also take up some other interesting topics in this episode. We're going to talk about Jack Burke. You remember Jack Burke?
I do. He was the young junior rider at Tour de l'Abitibi, and he had the adverse analytical finding.
Yeah, that was 5 years ago. But the story still kind of not only affects him today, but the sort of examination of that ruling also has some effects today, and we're going to look at that. I'm going to speak with Dan Dakin, senior editor here at the magazine. He did a really extensive story on Jack Burke, and we're going to delve into it. And something else is returning this episode, I believe, Dan.
Oh, yes. The streets have been talking. The people have been clamoring. We're bringing back Full Send, No Send.
That's right. Everybody's favorite segment. I'm very much looking forward to that because I peered at your notes and hot topics. They're just hot topics. All right. On with the show. Earlier in November, Peterborough, Ontario hosted the Canadian Cyclocross Championships. It was a pretty great race. There was snow, there was mud, there was wind. It was a very Canadian nationals. And the course made for some great racing. Ruby West and Michael Vandenham defended their Maple Leaf jerseys. Magalie Rochette got back into that Maple Leaf jersey. And there was some great racing all around. Now, at the top of the show, we heard John Noble's chainsaw of encouragement. John Noble is a junior rider, and he raced on that weekend. And he also had his chainsaw out. So I spoke with John about the chainsaw and its role at the cyclocross race. And I also spoke with Jasmine During. You probably know her as a bronze medal winning track cyclist in the Team Pursuit. But she has been racing cross, and she got right into the elite women's race. And I spoke with her right after that event to get her thoughts on cross and track.
Yeah, so I'm John Noble. I race with S&S Racing here in Peterborough. So it's pretty fantastic having a home race for Nationals. It's going to be a good time out here cheering before the race starts underway. Still got a while, but...
Well, we're in the midst of the Masters races, and you've brought some motivation. Tell us about what you got in your hands here.
I certainly have. I brought myself a chainsaw. No blade on it. Keeping it safe. But makes some wonderful noises. Motivates people up the hill. Gotten my fair share of scowls, smiles. I take that as motivation. Maybe they like it, maybe they don't, but definitely makes them go faster. And what more do you want than going faster? So...
And what inspired you to bring a chainsaw to a cyclocross race?
It's a big, over in the mountain bike side of the bike race world, mostly the downhill side, it's a pretty big, more common thing. Steve Smith, long live chainsaw. It's been around forever. So just bringing it over, pulled it out, and yeah, keeping people running. Maybe they're going fast up the hills now instead of going fast down the hills, but close enough.
Now, do you think it's the rev of the engine? Is it fear of being cut? What motivates people when they hear the sound of a chainsaw?
Probably, I've gotten a fair amount of comments about needing a mask to finish my Halloween getup. So I think people might be running away, but you never know.
Well, you've also got the plaid here. You've got the Peterborough dinner jacket going.
Yep. Fully outfitted for a good round of heckling, cheering, whatever you want to call it.
And you're going to be racing in the junior races a little later today.
I will be. 1 o'clock. Got some friends coming to take up my chainsaw and cheer me on, which will be nice. I'll definitely be going faster based off the noise. Not too afraid of my own
skill saw.
So it's gonna be a good time.
Well, thanks very much. Have a good luck in your race.
Thank you.
Jasmine Dering, how was it? You know, we think of you as a track racer, and yet you competed at Canadian National Cyclocross. How did you find it?
It was an amazing event. It's such a fun course, definitely the best course that I've raced on, and it's kind of my first real big cyclocross race other than some local racing. So, you know, I didn't know what to expect, especially with these conditions. First time ever riding in snow, but I had a ton of fun, and I'm actually super stoked on my ride. You know, I didn't really have a goal, but I just felt like, you know, I wasn't getting lapped, so that's that box checked. But yeah, ton of fun.
So to be cruel, you know, usually your discipline involves you turning left, but and now you have a pretty technical course. But still, is there anything you can pull over from your other, whether it's road or track experience, into cyclocross?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I definitely, on some of the more experienced riders, I lose some time through the really technical sections. But definitely the power sections and some of the steep climbs, that's where I kind of can make up a little bit of ground. So, yeah, definitely some of my track and road experience carries over. There's obviously a whole lot of new stuff I'm trying to learn, but I think, you know, just becoming a more well-rounded cyclist is always a good thing. So,
Is there more cyclocross in your future?
I don't know. I'll be racing tomorrow, and then we'll see. It's been a ton of fun, and I've also done a little bit of mountain bike racing. So it's been, just after almost 9 years of doing track, it's fun just to work on some of my weaknesses. And I know when I go back to the track that I'll be a better athlete for it.
All right. Yeah. It's sort of like a break or a change is as good as a vacation.
Yeah, you know, if you just keep doing the same thing, you're not going to get better. So, doing mountain bike, doing cyclocross, it's really put me outside of my comfort zone, obviously. And I think that's when you get better as an athlete.
The National Cyclocross Championships were held in Peterborough, Ontario on November 10th. John Noble is a junior rider with a chainsaw. Jasmine Dering is a track rider who's won Olympic medals in the team pursuit and recently participated in her first real cyclocross race. This year, Jack Burke, a young road cyclist who's based in Squamish, BC, had a pretty good season. He won the stage of the Tour de Beauce that featured the Mont Mégantic climb at the end. He also was second in the youth classification at the Colorado Classic. But 5 years ago, his cycling career was thrown into jeopardy. He was handed an adverse analytical finding. Now, I'm not ruining his story by saying he was cleared and found not guilty, but that failed test still haunts him today. Also, his case has effects that go beyond the sport of cycling even. In a recent issue of Canadian Cycling Magazine, senior editor Dan Dakin wrote an in-depth feature on Jack Burke and his case. Here's my conversation with Dan on Jack Burke's story. Dan Dakin, senior editor of Canadian Cycling Magazine, welcome.
Hey, thanks a lot. I appreciate you having me on here.
So, recently you did a feature story in the magazine about Jack Burke, a young Canadian cyclist. What can you tell us just briefly about Jack Burke and who he is?
Yeah, so first of all, I really enjoyed writing this story. It was, you know, one of these kind of deep dives that I like getting into. So Jack Burke, for those who don't know, is he's still a cyclist, raced this year for Jelly Belly. But 5 years ago in 2013, he's a junior rider racing with Team Canada. And he was racing at the Tour de l'Abitibi, has sort of a mediocre start to this stage race, wins the third stage, goes on to race the fourth stage, and then has a doping test and is caught with an adverse analytical finding. And then everything sort of blows up for this young man.
Yeah, now it's a really interesting story because of the nature of that adverse analytical finding. Now that's a phrase I think we're quite familiar with, thanks to Chris Froome. But so he gets this adverse analytical finding. It comes in the mail, I think, just maybe a month or two after the Tour of L'Abitibi, which is his summer junior race. And what did it say they found, or what was the adverse analytical finding for?
Yeah, so he found out that he had tested positive for HTCZ, which is hydrochlorothiazide. Everyone sort of just knows it as HTCZ. And, you know, immediately he's sort of, his mind is blown, right? He cannot understand this. This is a young man who, you know, ever since this happened has claimed his innocence, and obviously we'll get more into that. But basically it means he has failed a doping test, and, you know, everything that he's sort of worked for up to this point now goes into question.
Mm-hmm. Now, this pharmaceutical is a therapeutic diuretic. So it's, you know, it's prescribed to people, but I think the reason it's flagged is that it can be a masking agent for other things a cheater might be taking.
Yeah, exactly. That's the problem with it, is that, you know, it's not necessarily, it's not a performing enhancing substance. It's that it is used to hide other performing enhancing substances. And so that's why, you know, the UCI and WADA has it on its banned substance list.
So he gets handed this adverse analytical finding, and what is his reaction? And also, what is his father's reaction, or what is his father, how does he come into the story?
Yeah, I think for all of us, you know, you can think to a situation where you've disappointed your parents or something like that, or, they've kind of helped you get to whatever spot you're at in your career. And, you know, all of a sudden you have to have this conversation with them, like, they're saying I doped, and so that he had this conversation with his father, and you know, I think he was sort of afraid of the reaction he might get, but his father said, okay, listen, if you say you didn't do this, we are going to fight this, and his father basically set out to learn everything that he could learn, you know, about the testing and the substance, and kind of became his own personal defense attorney.
And what did his father, Dion, find out?
So this is really where this story gets so interesting, is, you know, it all comes down to circumstances. And the circumstances of his positive test was, you know, he's racing in the Tour de l'Abitibi. As I mentioned, there were two stages that he didn't do particularly well at. Stage three is this morning time trial. So he goes to this time trial. He actually wins the time trial, and it was in Brion-Noranda in Quebec. And from there, there was actually an evening or sort of late afternoon circuit race in Malartic. So all the riders, they make their way down to this small town. And there, at that point, everyone's kind of getting ready for this race, this fourth stage of the race. And everyone else had, you know, what Jack says, everyone else had filled their bottles right after the previous stage, or I guess there was some sort of a hotel or something. Anyway, they all filled their bottles separately. He didn't have the chance to do that. And so he gets to the start of this fourth stage and has to fill his bottles, just tries to find whatever place he can. And there's this community center where this stage was sort of being close to the start. And he runs in, he says to somebody working there, listen, I really need to fill my bottles. And the person lets him, fills his bottles, goes and does the race. And ultimately it was after that that he gets tested and, you know, is caught having this in his system. So what makes this so interesting is this town, Malartic, Quebec, it's actually home to the largest open pit gold mine in Canada. And has sort of been in the news because of this mine and because of the things that are in the town. And this mine sort of reopened, I think it was in like around 2010 or something, it reopened, and essentially the whole town, like 200 buildings, had to move. And it's just this sort of fascinating town with these weird environmental issues, and their drinking water comes from these deep wells in the ground. And so ultimately what Jack's dad kind of unpacked from this and learned from this was that the drinking water in Malartic is contaminated with hydrochlorothiazide. because this is a normal substance that can be found in some medication that senior citizens take. And so, you know, the argument and what they moved forward with their argument was that he inadvertently drank water that was contaminated with this hydrochlorothiazide. Didn't mean to do it, wasn't doing it for any sort of, you know, benefit to his cycling, but that he was the victim of circumstance. So it's just, you know, it's just such an interesting thing.
So then with this, armed with this knowledge or this theory, what was the next step for Burke?
Well, so the problem was, is this all sort of happened at a extreme, I don't know if there's a good time for something like this to happen, but it's certainly, for him, it was a very inopportune time. He was getting ready to go to the 2013 World Juniors in Italy, I think they were that year. So he's supposed to go, I think, middle of September, they're supposed to leave. Well, he finds out about this adverse analytical finding on August 16th. So, you know, less than a month before he's supposed to leave for, you know, what will be his biggest race to date, pretty well, he finds out that he's failed this test. So from there, he now has to go to a hearing, and the hearing in this case, I think, was done over the phone. But regardless, there's going to be a hearing, and he now has to defend himself. And so now he has to get a lawyer, basically, is what happens. And like, this is not somebody who, you know, understood the legal system or anything like that. Like, this is just a normal family who now has to defend their son and him defend himself from major allegations and this adverse analytical finding that could basically completely end his career.
Mm-hmm. So the hearing happens in September. A Toronto lawyer represents him, James Bunting, and the arbitrator at this hearing was Richard McLaren, who people may know from he was an arbitrator on Floyd Landis's doping case. So, and of course, the UCI is there. I understand it was a pretty intense but short hearing. Is that the case?
Yeah. And I just want to go back and just briefly mention James Bunting, his lawyer, because I think that's an interesting part of the story. And you know, his dad basically opened up the Yellow Pages. That was still a thing, I think, in 2013. So his dad basically tries to find a sport lawyer and calls a whole pile of sport lawyers, basically anybody that he can find who may be able to represent his son. And James Bunting is the only guy who calls back. As it turns out, that was sort of serendipitous. I mean, who he got in James Bunting was someone who was incredibly compassionate and was willing to take this case on and was willing to do a pro bono. He believed in this case. He believed that Jack Burke was being wronged. And, you know, he was willing to take this case on. And so, you know, that was such an important thing and such a big turning point for this case. But yeah, so this hearing, it's, I think it was 6 hours long or something, you know, and like you've got major players from the UCI who are taking part in this hearing because of what they believe was the significance of this case. You know, what they were arguing was that this was doping by accident, you could say, right? So this was ingesting this substance without knowing about it. And so the UCI, you know, really believe that this could be problematic. And so, yeah, it was like this 6 hour hearing where, you know, all these different people testified, but Burke and his team only had like a week to get ready for it. So there was only so much that they could do to kind of prepare for it.
Mm-hmm. So they have the hearing, and then if we skip a bit, I think the next dramatic scene in the story is Burke is actually at the airport. He's at, I believe, the Toronto airport with his, maybe he has his ticket in hand, but he wants to know if he can go to Worlds. But that all depends on what the arbitrator decides.
Well, it's kind of funny, and it really does sound like a movie. You know, it's exactly that climatic moment in a movie where he's sitting there and, you know, waiting for his lawyer to call, but that's exactly what happened. He's at the airport, ready to go to the Worlds, James Bunting calls him and says, "Listen, you're good to race. You've been cleared," and we can kind of expand on that a little bit, but, you know, there were some ramifications, but basically, you know, it was ruled that he did not ingest this HCTZ intentionally, and that was the big thing. So it meant you can kind of continue on with your career.
Right. So sort of happy ending. I mean, happy at that point, but as I understand it, the UCI wasn't done with Jack Burke just yet, or even this decision.
Yeah, and that goes back to what we were talking about with the UCI, you know, believing that this was such an important case. So, you know, when Richard McLaren ruled that this was unintentional ingestion, you know, now this is problematic because of the precedent that it sets, right? So, you know, now you have an athlete who has been essentially found not guilty for because it was unintentional ingestion. And that comes with all kinds of ramifications.
And it wasn't just unintentional in the sense that he took a supplement that had it. Like, there was no way of him knowing. It was environmental.
Exactly. So, and that was a key part of it. Yeah, and that was something that McLaren said, was this was not a nutritional supplement. This is not something that he could possibly have known was going to be a problem. Right. This was water. This was and public drinking water. So the UCI was not at all happy with this ruling, and they took it to the top. They took it all the way to the International Court of Arbitration for Sport. And they wanted to fight this. They wanted to see this changed.
And so we're back, sort of in a court-like case in a legal setting, and. What is the outcome of this sort of second round for Jack Burke?
Well, so this is, again, another interesting turning point in the story. With that first ruling, you know, McLaren had said, okay, it was unintentional ingestion. However, like he's saying he shouldn't be banned, but he's saying there should still be a doping infraction on his record, right? So he's saying you're not totally cleared. You did this unintentionally, but that the victory in Quebec, that's not going to count. That's, you know, there's going to be a doping infraction on your record, but you're, you know, free to move on with your career. So there's no 2-year ban. So when the case goes to the Court of Arbitration, at that point, now you have the benefit of time, right? So now this, I think, happened in October of that year. So it's sort of an extra month worth of preparation time that James Bunting and his team was able to do. And obviously the UCI also was preparing a lot. But ultimately what happens is that the International Court of Arbitration says, okay, McLaren was right. This was unintentional doping, but he was wrong to have any sort of infraction on his record. So they actually take it a step further and they say, you know, McLaren got it wrong. This kid's clear. There's nothing there. You know, this is unintentional doping and you are free to go. Essentially. It really was the best possible outcome for Jack Burke.
So the sort of nightmare is over for Burke. We're going to come back to Burke, but what I think we should talk about is the significance of this case, and has it had any precedence for other athletes outside of cycling?
Yeah, so ultimately that's why the UCI was, you know, so concerned with this case, was because of the precedent that it could set for other cases, not just in cycling. You know, WADA is concerned with what it could do for other sports. So, you know, in researching the story, we looked at, you know, were there other cases, and we did find one for sure. And it's this gymnast, Kristen Schaldibin. So she had been competing somewhere near Lake Michigan. She drinks a whole pile of water right before she competes and ultimately gets tested. And again, she tests positive for HCTZ. So ultimately, her lawyer now looks back at the Burke case and uses the Burke case as part of his evidence, you know, into why she should be, why her case should be cleared. And ultimately, same thing happened. She was found with a no-fault ruling. She's free to go. So, I mean, you have to say that, yes, that certainly was an example of where the Burke case, you know, played a role, and that a precedent was set.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's almost as if Burke's case happened too soon for him. And by that, I mean, like, since then, studies have come out showing that, you know, even in southern Ontario, because we shouldn't just be casting aspersions on Malartic and northern Quebec, but, you know, these drugs, these pharmaceuticals that people are taking are showing up in the water table. So there was a study, I believe, in 2014 that showed, yes, southern Ontario has, you know, metformin and HCTZ in the waterways.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there's just, I think just within the last year, there was something that came out where they were finding, you know, fish in, I think it was Lake Erie, that had high levels of, you know, depression drugs in them, right? So it's the nature of our environment where, you know, people are flushing drugs down the sink and, you know, and it's ending up in our water sources. So this is an issue.
So let's return to Burke. He went on to continue racing. He, as you mentioned, he was on Jelly Belly this past year. The year before that, he was on an under 23 development team. 2017 was good for him. He was best young rider at Tour of Alberta. This year, he's had some good results, I believe.
Yeah, for sure. But you know what's kind of funny is that, as you say, sort of 2016, 17, you know, obviously this year, those were good for him. The problem was you had this, you know, this young cyclist who had a lot of talent, and 2013 was when he had all his issues, but 2014, 2015, like he had a very difficult time getting a break after this. And, you know, ultimately, you can't help but acknowledge that there's this skepticism, right? And it's not just with fans of cycling; it's with people who run teams. You know, it's with the industry, right? Everybody's sort of nervous about somebody who has this on their record, even though he was cleared. It's still there, and that's what Jack Burke really struggled with was you know, people believing his story and people taking the time to actually listen to his story.
So soon after the he was cleared, he was still haunted by this, but I don't know, are things all good today?
You know, you would like to think so. They should be, but no, you know, the truth of the matter is not. And you know, we talked to him this this year, and he just won, you know, a major stage at Tour de Beauce, and the biggest win of his career. And right away, people on his Facebook page are saying things like, I think someone made a comment, you know, he must have been drinking some more of that Malartic water. And you know, here we are, we're 5 years down the road from this, and he obviously has, you know, has proven himself as a cyclist, but that's still there, right? It's still, that doubt is still there, and you're still going to get people who are going to question anything that he does. And you see that. It's not just with Jack Burke. It's with, you know, anybody who has ever sort of had an adverse analytical finding. No matter what the outcome of that is, it's going to be on their record book permanently.
After doing this research into this story, you've looked at, say, the nature of drug testing and actually what can be found through this drug testing. What do you think that's going to mean, say, moving forward for cycling?
Well, you know, I think what this case showed and what others have shown is that there's kind of an unfair situation happening where, you know, it depends where you are. It depends on timing. In the case of Jack Burke, his drug test happened at this lab that is one of the best in the world. And so there was only a trace amount of HCTZ found in his system, but he was tested at a lab that, you know, had equipment that was able to test to such a level that he was caught. So if he had not been tested there, you know, let's say he had this result in, you know, somewhere in the States or you know, somewhere in Europe or something, there's a legitimate chance that he would not have tested positive for this. So I think what we're seeing is that, you know, there is a problem with the drug testing system when all labs aren't able to test in the same way. And, you know, ultimately there's a problem in sport when you have people who, when they're found innocent, they are guilty. So they have to live with this for the rest of their career, regardless of what happened. And I don't know. I don't know how you fix that. I know how you fix the lab issue. I know how you fix the testing issue. And that is by standardizing things and making sure that things are fair for everybody. But I don't know how you test the, it's almost a societal problem. And that's that we're skeptical, right? We're very skeptical when we hear these sorts of things.
Dan, this is fascinating stuff. Thank you for telling us this story.
Well, thank you very much. I really did enjoy writing it, you know, and I found it fascinating. And I encourage people to read the story. And that's what Jack Burke says too. Is, you know, listen, you don't have to like me. You don't have to think anything that you don't want about Jack Burke. But what he wants is he wants you to listen to his story and at least read the whole thing, and then you make a decision. You know, don't jump to conclusions. So I encourage people to do that.
And that's a good point. Readers can find that story on cyclingmagazine.ca. Thanks again, Dan.
Thank you.
Jack Burke is a road cyclist who raced with the North American Continental Team Jelly Belly this past season. Dan Dakin is a senior editor of Canadian Cycling Magazine. Dan, if you could, please set your stopwatch.
And go. We got 6 hot minutes.
Okay, go. Hit me.
All right. It's shoulder season right now. Mm-hmm. Some people are on the trainer. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you're outside. Mm-hmm. What do you do with your trainer and or Zwift rides? Do they make an appearance on Strava, or do you keep your Strava pure, full send, no send?
Keep your Strava pure.
Yes.
So this is like the equivalent of like straight edge Strava stream.
Yes, there is a purity and a sanctity to the Strava stream.
You're like the Fugazi of Strava.
Yes.
Everybody's Zwifting.
I think you're dating yourself because I don't get that
all
reference.
Right, whatever. So, I mean, I get it to a certain extent because I find people's whatever trainer rides not particularly engaging. I'm going to be super diplomatic right now. Not particularly engaging. I'd rather see what you did outside, even if it's just a rinky-dink ride. But like, whatever. Strava is just a vehicle for often your data. Maybe you're moving it around from one platform to another. I had to get some stuff into Exert that after I did my trainer ride, so I needed Strava to connect it.
Strava can be the conduit to other platforms.
If you will. So it's so ubiquitous that, I don't know.
You're a no send on keeping Strava pure.
Yeah, because whatever. It's a social media platform that has all the social media baloney that social media has. So whatever. There's no purity. Purity is a myth in Strava.
I'm going to have to agree. Pedaling's pedaling.
Oh, I did not expect that.
Yeah. Get your Zwift out there. Get your trainer road out there. Also, your trainer road graphs are pretty boring. Let's give you another picture. But pedaling's pedaling. It's all good.
Oh, I did not expect that. I thought you'd come out swinging for the don't show me your trainer.
All right, we're going to move on.
Yes, quickly.
Tabor World Cup, the women's race. Mm-hmm. A tiny little hill became a mountain more than a molehill.
Oh, boy.
Making the pros look like Joes. Full send, no send.
I mean, what's to full send or no send? The hill's the hill. It was slippery. It was sending. It did make, I don't know if it made pros look like Joes. It definitely made Joes feel better.
We've all been there at some silly run-up that we couldn't get up.
Joes and Janes.
Joes in the metaphorical sense.
Okay.
You know, we're... Anyways.
We've all been there.
We've all been there. We've all been at some silly run-up that we couldn't get up. You know, maybe friends and family were watching. But the real no-send here belongs to the mechanics. Where were the spikes?
Was that the mechanics? They should have been, like, putting spikes in everybody. All right. All right. So we got to blame somebody. All right, next.
All right. The Saitama Criterium in Japan, put on by ASO,
yep.
The organizers of the Tour de France.
Tour de France.
Baseball's big in Japan. They had Garen Thomas,
Alberto Conter. I can't believe you said big in Japan.
Alberto Contador, Alejandro Valverde.
It's an Alphaville reference.
No, I got it. And Alexander Kristoff dressed up in baseball gear. Now, I was impressed by the baseball skills of Garen Thomas.
Really?
Yeah. He whacked that T-ball.
It was a
T-ball. All the way out of the field into somebody's head.
Yeah, okay, but the stands like weren't past an outfield. They were like right there, and yes, he clocked a woman in the face, I believe.
Have you seen most like pro cyclists try and do ball sports?
No, but I guess there's a reason they're doing.
Well, I saw Alberto Contador try and swing the baseball.
Yeah, and I think Kristoff wasn't so good either.
Yeah, no, he missed the T-ball. He missed the T-ball 3 or 4 times. I saw that swing.
All right, I mean, you know, it's good to see that they have their limits to their skills. You know, they're good at pedaling their bikes.
It makes me feel better.
All right. So, wait a minute. Where do we conclude then? No send on baseball, but full send on making them look foolish?
Full send on making them look foolish. No send on them playing baseball.
All right. What's next?
Did Matthew Vanderpool ruin the cross season for you?
I know your feeling on this. I mean,
that's full send, no send, by the way.
Full send?
Full send. He's ruined it.
Well, I mean, how do I fault a guy for just being the strongest guy there? It makes for boring racing. So, yeah, full send, he ruined it. But full send, like, you go win. That's your job.
No, we need to take a page out of the Manitoba cyclocross book.
The who?
The Manitoba cyclocross.
Make him chop wood.
Chop wood. Maybe Vanderpool needs to wear clogs.
Yeah. Something to make it like not so ridiculous runaway.
Pound a funnel of freet every other lap.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because there are some Manitoba races where the elite riders are handicapped slightly by having to do these other feats during the race, like chopping wood. I can't remember some of the other ones, but it's a creative way to like not have it be a runaway, and it's just entertaining as heck to see some guy getting off his bike, split wood, and keep going.
It's a full send here.
All right.
You guys ruined it.
All right. There you go. Do you have time left?
We got 25 seconds.
Oh, do we have another topic? Oh, I got one off the top of my head. Winter cross in Canada. Should the UCI push forward with its rules? Do we want to have cross nats in January?
I don't think the guys in Belgium have really been to Sherbrooke or Peterborough in January.
Or Winnipeg, for that matter.
That's a no send. You Belgians don't know real cold.
You don't know real cold. And, you know, if you want to globalize the sport, look at the globe. Oh.
Time's up.
Did it. All right. Another great session of Full Send, No Send.
All right, this has been episode 5 of the Canadian Cycling Magazine podcast. Remember, tell your riding buddies, tell your friends. Next time you do a cafe stop, tell your barista. And if you want more from us, follow us on Instagram at Canadian Cycling, on Twitter at Canadian Cycling as well. On Facebook, we're at Cycling Mag. If you want to know where to find us, we're on iTunes, we're on Stitcher, we're on Google Play, we're on Spotify, we're on Intune. Rate, review, download, but... No, that's only if it's 5 stars.
Okay, 5 stars, please. Yeah, please rate. Those really help us out. And yeah, thank you for listening. This episode was put together by Dan Walker over there, by Philippe Tremblay, and me, Matthew Piaro. It was produced by Adam Killick.
Shout out to that man on the ones and twos. Now, if we want more full send, no sends, what we're asking for is you to send in your ideas to podcast@cyclingmagazine.ca. We're going to try and get those in next week.
Yes, we'd love to hear your controversial topics that... we can either go full send or no send on. Please email us those. And for more news and all things cycling related, head over to cyclingmagazine.ca. And as always, thank you to the Ontario Media Development Corporation for its support. We'll talk to you next time.